Welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey, delighted to have you with us. And we're going to be around for an hour talking. We're following the money, as we always do. We're leading off with Tom O'Rourke. He is an attorney, a Washington area attorney, actually based in Rockville. And he's going to be talking about estate planning and managing your money and that sort of thing. Tom and I are trying to figure out how long we've known each other. It's probably been close to 30 years.
It's been a while. It's been a long time.
I remember I was at a out-of-town conference, and they had different seminars, and I wanted to just pop in and you know, be seen and then leave. And I went into yours and stayed for the full 3 hours. It was, you know, just absolutely riveting. And then Tom later on did some estate planning for me, which is so I cannot recommend him high enough. Tom, thanks for trekking down here from Rockville.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. I'm glad to be here.
Listen, the average federal, I guess most people are probably worth more than we think we are.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, they talk about, well, I don't have a $1 million estate and all this, but you know, in the Washington area, I guess in particular, maybe here more than almost anywhere else in the country, people have homes. Somebody once said the secret of financial success is to have gotten married 30 years ago and stay married.
That's right. Every time somebody mentions that, I think of a lady that I met a number of years ago. I started the meeting by saying, if you have more than $1 million in assets, we at least need to think about doing some tax planning. She said, for God's sake, yeah. Tom, I'm a federal employee. What do you think I am? And then we went through the meeting, and she proceeded to tell me she'd been a long-term government employee. She had money in the thrift plan. She bought a home when she moved to the D.C. area in the mid-60s. She had some life insurance. Her husband had some life insurance. He had a TSP account. And I was jotting down some numbers, and I said to you, do you realize you're worth $1.5 million?
Oh, yeah.
And she said, well, if I'm worth so much money, how come I never seem to have any?
Yeah.
And that's something a lot of folks can relate to. Most of the things that they have that are really worth something, they can't spend.
Right.
Their retirement, their house, their TSP is not available to them until they retire, their life insurance. And many people do tend to underestimate the value of their estate.
Well, to me, estate planning is akin to long-term care insurance. You know, the difference is in long-term care, you hope you won't need it. In estate planning, regrettably, someday we all got to go, so it will happen. But I see both of them as a gift to your children if you have them, or your loved ones or your family.
Absolutely. When you do a good estate plan, even if taxes aren't an issue, and even if you don't have a lot of money, by having a clear plan, you can make things a whole lot easier for your children. If you express what your wishes are clearly, in all likelihood, they're going to follow those wishes. Not because they necessarily get along with their brother or sister, but because they respect mom or dad.
Right. And then if you have appointed someone to act as the estate planner, that takes the heat off the older brother or the younger sister doing it. Tom, as I was telling people before the show, I could leave the studio and just let you go, because I know you do seminars and things all the time. But what do you want to get over? What do you want to tell people?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things people really need to look at is they need to be aware that at the end of this year, there could be a fairly dramatic change in the estate tax laws. Right now, the average federal employee simply doesn't need to worry about federal estate tax planning, because the amount that's exempt from tax is $5 million. And let's face it, most of us don't have $5 million. But at the end of this year, unless Congress does something, the federal estate tax exemption is going to drop to $1 million. Now, that's still a huge amount of money. But the typical federal employee who's a longtime federal employee, who's lived in a major metropolitan area and owned a home, has a little bit of life insurance, a little bit of money in the TSP, and has an annuity under either CSRS or FERS, may well have an estate that is worth $1 million or more. And if Congress doesn't do anything with the federal estate tax law, that individual could face a significant tax liability. Let me just give you a very simple example. Let's say we have a husband and wife that between the two of them has $1.5 million. If the federal estate tax exemption drops to $1 million and both of those individuals die, they could face a federal estate tax liability of close to $250,000. That's real money, and it takes years and years and years to earn, save, pay taxes on, invest, and accumulate that amount of money. And through a little bit of estate planning, they can generally take steps that will help them either mitigate or totally avoid that. So people need to be on the lookout for what's going to happen with the tax law at the end of this year.
You're worth more than you think.
Yeah,
just
absolutely.
I guess everybody is worth. Now, the typical TSP balance, it seems to me, is like $130,000. So right away, if that's the average, that means a lot of people have more than that, many have less than that. But that's a lot of money. If you're a homeowner in the Washington area, you may be, even with the depressed prices, you may be sitting on a gold mine. I had no idea that it was $5 million now. And when you say exempt from that, what does that mean? If I left $5 million, taxes on it?
If you left $5 million, there would be no federal estate tax whatsoever. Now, there may be a state estate tax. We have 50 states and they have 50 different sets of laws. But for folks who live in the D.C. metropolitan area, you may need to be concerned about a state estate tax if you live in either Maryland or D.C. Virginia completely eliminated its estate tax a number of years ago. And I know the show is broadcast to places outside the D.C. area, and what the estate tax laws may be in your state, they just vary all over the lot. Some states, the estate tax kicks in if you have assets of more than $300,000. That's in Ohio. Mm-hmm. In New Jersey, if you have assets more than $600,000. Many states have $1 million cutoff. But the estate tax exemption for the last several years has been at $5 million. That was part of a last-minute compromise between President Obama and a Republican leadership in Congress in 2010. And what's going to happen at the end of this year is anybody's guess.
Does something have to happen, or, I mean, does it revert to $1 million?
Right. This is part of what is commonly referred to as the Bush tax cuts.
Uh-huh.
Unless Congress does something affirmative, the exemption drops back to $1 million. And that's just one very, very small part of what could happen. For folks who are listening to this and tuning us out saying, I don't have $1 million, I'm not worried about that. Well, there are other things that could change that affect everybody. For example, right now the lowest tax bracket for income tax is 10%. That tax bracket is going to go away. So anybody who earns money could see a portion of their income taxed at a rate that's 5% higher than they've been paying for the last 9 years. So the tax law that is about to expire could have very dramatic effects on everybody who has any income.
And none of the expiration is good, right?
No, none of it's good.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it depends on your perspective. The effect of all the expiration is going to be to increase everybody's tax liability. Everybody who has earned income pays Social Security tax. And unless Congress does something, the amount of Social Security tax you pay is going to increase by 2%. Unless the current law is extended.
Just about everybody needs an estate, and there's certainly those three documents you mentioned that people do need. We're all worth more dead than alive, and we're all worth more than we think we are. I was telling you what I hope is a fascinating story about Uncle and Aunt I lived with when I was a kid in Kentucky, and he was very eccentric and, as I said, well-read, not well-educated. But he had a temper, and he would, no telling how many wills he wrote, and he'd do it in pen and goose quill pen and that sort of thing. And he left things to various religious sects that he'd never had any dealings with. And at one point, the will that they found, it was no telling which will it was that he had intended, but the one that he'd found benefited his wife, whom he disliked intensely, and gave very little to his daughter, whom he loved dearly. And, of course, people figured somebody had cherry-picked and found the will they wanted. But he, using, you know, lack of, you know, being your own lawyer, he intended to leave his daughter the farm. But what he did in writing it was he left her the buildings on the farm, but not the land itself. Something about real property or whatnot. But he was the example of having a fool for a lawyer.
That does happen. That happens. People that handle these matters in a local register of wills office, when I talk to them, I say, you could write a book. And they say, boy, we sure could, because what you just described, unfortunately, is not uncommon. People many times will write a will, change their mind, not destroy the will, rewrite one, The new one gets lost, and the old one's the one that's found. And the one that's found and offered to probate is the operative will, unless somebody can prove that it was revoked. And many times they can't do that.
The first book that I ever heard of that was self-published that actually became a bestseller was one, you made me think of it, called How to Avoid Probate.
Oh, absolutely.
And I was just a young guy, didn't know what probate, what is that?
Well, How to Avoid Probate was written by a gentleman named Norman Dacey. And Mr. Dacey had a good idea, but he got in a lot of trouble for other reasons that I'll explain in a minute. Yeah. But what he was talking about is how you can create a revocable trust. You create the Mike Causey Revocable Trust, and you make it the owner of your property. And when you die, the trust is a legal entity. It doesn't die when you do. It just has another person who steps in, a new trustee steps in after you die. Because the entity that owns the property, the trust, didn't die, you do avoid probate. And revocable trusts are now a very, very common tool in many estate plans. And they do a lot of things, but one of the main goals that many people have when they set up a revocable trust is that they do it with the goal of avoiding probate, and it works. Now, Mr. Dacey carried his theory a step beyond that. He took the position that the trust was a separate entity. He assigned all of his income to the trust. He didn't report or pay any income tax, and he got in a big fight with the IRS, and like so many people, he lost.
Yeah.
But it was, Mr. Dacey was sort of a revolutionary at his time. Yeah. He did come up with an idea that has been widely adopted and used by many people. Any estate planning lawyer, I'm sure, uses revocable trusts all the time as part of the tools they recommend to their clients.
But they also recommend pay your taxes.
You pay your taxes.
Yeah.
You earn your money, you pay your taxes.
What do they say? Half of all marriages end in divorce.
Right.
Numerous people, it's hard. I guess maybe many of us know more divorced people than single or than married. In a second or a third marriage, is a prenuptial agreement a good idea? And how would you broach that?
To answer your first question, it's always a good idea.
Okay.
Probably is a good idea even the first time around.
Uh-huh.
But when you're 20 or 25 years old, neither you nor your intended has anything, so you don't do it.
Yeah.
But it's a good idea. It's always a good idea. How you broach it is something I've never been able to figure out. It always comes across that I love you, but I'm not quite sure I trust you.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to do. When I speak to people, I say, look, you know, now is the time of your life when you love and trust each other. Why not lay everything out clearly? Because many times people will have children from a first marriage that they want to protect. They love their spouse. They want to provide for their spouse. They also want to protect their children. And I know I had an example of a couple that had been married for over 50 years. And the man was insisting that his wife put all of her assets in a trust. And he gave the example. He said, Helen, you remember what happened when Mary died? Every widow in the neighborhood started bringing casseroles to Charlie. And one thing led to another. Uh-huh. They got married. And he put her name on everything, and when he died, their kids got nothing. Everything went to her. And he insisted he didn't want that to happen to his kids because he said, that's the type of guy I would be.
Mm-hmm.
I would be lonely if I lost you. So
Protect me from myself.
Protect me from myself. And that many times is what people do in their estate plan. It generally, having a prenup for a marriage after your first marriage, particularly if you have children from that first marriage, is very important.
I would think, too, that, you know, it, rather than being insulting to somebody, that it protects both, and there's just as good a chance that the woman will have as much money or more than the man, and there's just as good a chance that the woman will love her kids and want to protect them as the man would with his family.
Well, and many times, particularly in the D.C. area, the issue becomes the house. They'll move into the house of one spouse or the other, and when the first spouse dies, they want to make sure their spouse has a right to live there for the rest of their life because that's become their home. But they also want it ultimately to go to the kids. And in the second marriage situation, you want to make sure your kids don't force your second spouse out because they want to cash in.
Yeah.
They can't wait till the second spouse dies.
And I guess there's a way to handle that if you're... If your spouse outlives you, he or she lives in the house. But what happens if they marry again? And does the house then go to the second spouse?
That typically, I mean, if it's planned properly, no. If it's not planned properly, virtually anything can happen.
Okay, Tom, would you give us your email address real quick? And thank you so much for being here. If people want to get in touch.
Okay. Yeah, my email is t.o'rourke, O-R-O-U-R-K-E, at Miles Stockbridge. That's all one word, MILES STOCKBRIDGE.com.
All right. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Taking a trek from Rockville, and we'll see you again soon. Be right back on Federal News Radio.
Hi.
Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. Thanks for being with us. You may have noticed earlier that we had Tom O'Rourke as our guest on the show. We had a technical glitch with our original and intended guest, but I'm delighted that we had pulled up that sound from Tom's interview here. He's a wonderful attorney. He's a Vietnam vet, former IRS lawyer based now in Rockville, Maryland, and some really good ideas on how to keep your money after you're gone, as it were. And now we're going to move over to how to get some of that money, how to build up an estate. And we'll be talking with Steve Losey, who's a senior writer with the Federal Times. Steve, are you with us?
I'm here. How are you, Mike?
Hey, thank you for standing by. I hope you got to hear that show. Very interesting. And I know you've dealt with Tom O'Rourke before. Hey, first things first, in the money chase, what's the status of the pay freeze?
Okay, the House Appropriations Committee on Monday night, they unveiled the latest continuing resolution. This is the bill that will keep the government from shutting down at the end of this month. It's going to fund the government kind of on a temporary basis for another 6 months through March 27th. Basically, because Congress can't get their act together enough to actually pass the budgets, which is kind of their most important job, they have resorted to continuing resolutions over and over and over for the last couple of years. And this is just continuing that process. And so basically, it's going to keep the government funded at more or less 2012 levels through March. Now, here's where the pay raise issue comes into play. As all your listeners know, their pay has been frozen for the last 2 years. And originally, it was supposed to end, the pay freeze was supposed to end at the end of 2012, and the next pay raise was supposed to take effect in January. Obama said, let's give them a half a percentage point pay raise. However, last month, Obama sent a letter to Congress saying that until Congress passes an actual budget, and as long as federal agencies are funded on a continuing resolution, the pay freeze should be continued. So that means that pay is going to be frozen until at least April of next year. And there is a decent chance that it could go even longer.
Right. I know the presidents of the AFGE, the new president, and Colleen Kelly of the National Treasury Employees Union have both said they're going to make it a top priority to get a pay raise retroactive to January 1. But I would think those chances are slim and none, huh?
Yeah, it's not looking good, to be honest. And the issue of the issue behind the retroactive pay raise thing, when Obama said we're going to extend the pay freeze, he said it's going to, whenever the raise is passed along with the budget, assuming it is, it's going to take effect that day. It's not going to be retroactive to January, which is what has been done sometimes in the past. And so the unions, AFG and NTU, are going to push them to make it retroactive and reimburse federal employees for the pay raise that they missed out on. However, I think the odds are against them. I think the Republicans, especially the Republicans in the House, have been making political hay out of what they say are overpaid and overcompensated federal employees for several years now. They've pushed for a longer pay freeze. Paul Ryan, the vice presidential nominee for the Republicans, has pushed for a 5-year pay freeze. And so I think there's definitely no appetite on the Republican side to to give federal employees a pay raise, let alone make it retroactive. And I suspect that, you know, while the sausage is being made, the sausage of legislation is being made, a pay raise could get left on the floor.
As Bismarck said, you don't want to see sausage or laws being made.
And exactly.
True it was. And the irony of it is here is when you're talking about if the continuing resolution passes, as we assume it will, that spending will be held at 2012 level. But in fact, because they've been operating on continuing resolutions for so long, having, as you said, failed to do their basic job, which is approve budgets. Really, some of these agencies are operating I would think, budgets of 2009.
In some cases, yeah. The budget process for the federal government has been so messed up for so long. It's just such a mess. One thing that that this continuing resolution bill does do, it's not exactly 2012 spending levels. It would be $1.047 trillion. This would add 0.6% to 2012 levels. And they made a few exceptions for certain agencies that are going to need just slight little tick ups in their budget to handle unavoidable contingencies. A few agencies getting small increases. Customs and Border Protection are going to get an unspecified amount of extra money to maintain their current levels of CBP officers and Border Patrol agents. The Veterans Benefits Administration at VA, they've been having a noticeable increase in the workload of disability claims, largely because of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So VBA, the Benefits Administration, is going to get $2.2 billion under this continuing resolution, which would be a 7% increase over 2012 levels. And Interior and the agriculture departments, they've been fighting fires all this year. There's surely going to be wildfires next year, especially with all the droughts we've been having. So they're going to get slight tick-ups in their budget for firefighting.
Okay, but no big surge in hiring anywhere, huh?
No, that's definitely out of the question with the budget realities.
We've talked about the pay freeze, which has gone on 2 years so far. Salaries are frozen in effect at 2010 levels, and they're likely to extend it at least a year, maybe under the, as you said, the Ryan plan, perhaps another 2 or 3 years. But you guys did some research, some interesting research, and I'm going to build upon it myself by talking about the within grade raises and the sort of hidden pay raises that federal workers have had during this period of a freeze.
That's right. You know, one thing that the pay freeze did not do is it did not address the within grade step increases, did not address, did not stop pay raises for promotions. So calling it a pay freeze is something of a misnomer. It's more of a pay scale freeze, since, you know, for hundreds of thousands of federal employees, their pay is still going up. Now, of course, that there are thousands more who have maxed out in their grades, who have reached the top step, step 10. There are others who are in the higher steps that, you know, step 7 through 9, you only get an increase once every 3 years. So not everybody is getting a raise, but it has not been an absolute hard and fast pay freeze.
Right. One more thing about that. We need to take a short break here, and we'll be right back talking more about WIGs within grade raises. Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. I'm talking with Steve Losey. He's a senior writer with the Federal Times, and we were discussing the federal pay, and that in spite of the two-year freeze, some workers, thanks to longevity step increases and a satisfactory rating, have gotten a 3% raise during this freeze period. And, Steve, I guess there are some in the first three steps of the grade who have gotten two raises.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the way the step increase system works is if you're in steps 1 through 3, you get a raise, you get another step increase every year, which brings, as you said, a 3% raise. Then the next three, it's every 2 years. After that, every 3 years, and then you're maxed out. So by my kind of rough back of the envelope calculations, there's about 1.5 million GS employees in the government right now, and I think about roughly half of them would be eligible for one step increase or another next year. Plus, there's an unknown number of people who get promotions. So while the lack of a pay scale increase that is more or less a cost of living increase is unfortunate for many federal employees, it hasn't been entirely dry the last couple of years.
Right. Yeah, those step increases, I know the Carter administration went after them to no avail, kind of a half-hearted attempt at getting eliminating them for some kind of performance pay system. But if you look at the spread, say it's something like GS-11, I was checking in the Washington area, the difference between being a step 1 and step 10, top of the grade, is about $11,000 a year. So that's a considerable sum of money.
Yeah. You know, when I've written about this in the past, people who support the current system the way it is now say, well, those step increases aren't automatic. You have to be doing a good job. Agencies can withhold step increases if you're not cutting it. And that is technically true, but the way it works in reality, very, very few of these step increases actually get withheld for cause. I think last year I got some stats from OPM, and it worked out to roughly 0.8% of federal employees had their step increases withheld.
So just about everybody gets it.
Yeah, just about everybody.
Yeah, they're not automatic. They're semi-automatic, huh?
Yeah.
That's very interesting. Well, I know when the Carter people went after it, his top personnel person was a fan of the book and the movie Being There with Peter Sellers, and he referred to them as being their raises, as in, if you show up, don't commit murder on the job, you get the raise. And that was his take in private. He did not want to be quoted on that. Moving along here, the Washington Post has an interesting story today. It says that Dan Tangerlini, the acting head of the General Services Administration, said he aims for GSA's DNA and actually going after investigating it and talking with employees and whatnot, he's literally looking at the culture of GSA to see if there's something there that promotes and condones these kinds of excessive parties and conferences that they've been known to have.
That's right. You know, there's a hearing going on right now on Capitol Hill. My colleague Andy Medici, who's been a guest on your show multiple times, is there right now. And one thing that you can say about Dan Tangerlini, nobody can accuse him of giving short shrift to this scandal. He is acutely aware of just how damaging the whole Las Vegas scandal has been. And for people who may be unaware, this is basically a scandal that broke a couple of months ago. GSA spent about $823,000 on a big blowout bash in Las Vegas. There were parties, there were silly skits, there were just lavish food and alcohol there, and it kind of has become a symbol for excessive government waste, and it brought down the top leadership at GSA, multiple top leaders, and Dan Tangerlini from Treasury was put in charge of GSA, and since then he has been kind of clearing house, getting rid of these very loosely organized bonus programs that ended up being something of slush funds or being used as. He is trying to kind of go in and tear out the problems by the roots.
Yeah, the desert, the thing in Las Vegas that you referred to was particularly over the top because the people who were running it said they wanted it to be over the top. They wanted to exceed the party that had been held before, and that was Region 9, which is on the West Coast, and it had a reputation in the agency of being where the fun people operate, and it backfired big time on them.
Yeah. There was kind of a, over the last couple of years, these conferences just kept getting bigger and better and more elaborate and more crazy. And yeah, there was kind of a culture where one region wanted to outdo the other, you know, every year.
And this included gifts, and I guess the one they had here in Arlington, in the D.C. suburbs, that's the one that had a team-building exercise. It involved something like a purchase of 2,000 pairs of drumsticks.
Yeah.
Not the chicken kind. But.
Yeah. What baffles me about that is, you know.
What next?
You can get drumsticks pretty cheaply, I know, especially if you're buying them in bulk. I don't know why they spent tens of thousands of dollars on those. But, yeah, there's it's kind of brought a sharp eye from Congress on these conferences that are held by that agencies are holding. And it's not just GSA. The Veterans Affairs Department has come under severe criticism for two HR conferences they held last year that cost more than $5 million, including just really expensive video parody videos they had produced, gifts, and their allegations of improper gifts being given from the hotels to the people at VA who were organizing these conferences, that is. So this is the big story of this year is what are government agencies spending on these conferences, and is it wasteful? And to be sure, not all of these conferences are just big boondoggle junkets. Many of these conferences do have legitimate purposes. Many of them do have do help agencies and help federal employees get their jobs done, help them learn new tasks, help them network with their counterparts across the country who they don't see, and figure out solutions to the problems that vex them every day.
Right, and an important one, the one held in Nashville, Tennessee, very recently, last couple of weeks, where there's still a flap about whether the IG overstepped himself or not. But that conference had to do with the smart cards, and as I understand it, industry people paid for most of the conference.
Yeah. So it's going to be important as Congress and agencies go forward to not kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater and just get rid of all conferences, because conferences are important.
Yeah, face-to-face is good. Need to take a short break here. When we come back, I'd like to ask you about to use the S word. Be right back. Welcome back to Your Turn. I'm Mike Causey, and I'm talking with Stephen Losey, senior writer with the Federal Times. And Steve, in our tiny little world, everybody is using the S word almost every day. S is for sequestration, and that's the automatic across-the-board cuts that would go into effect January 2nd if what doesn't happen.
If Congress doesn't come up with a way to an agreement on how to cut $1.2 trillion over the next decade, then yes, these sequestration cuts will go into effect. I should say, if they don't come up with an agreement or pass a bill that kind of passes the buck and pushes these sequestration cuts off, that is another option. But yeah, at least nominally, the way to avoid sequestration is to come up with a
do the right thing.
Yeah,
deficit do what
deal.
They're supposed. Well, very obviously, various groups, federal unions, federal management groups, groups representing contractors and other interested parties say sequestration would be the end of civilization as we know it, talking about 270,000 plus federal jobs that would be lost, the threat of furloughs and or layoffs. Industry representatives had talked about at least that many jobs in the contracting field being lost. And I heard one the other day that put the estimate up to 1 million jobs. So it's 1 million and counting. The Congress some time ago passed legislation instructing the Obama administration, the White House, to come up with a blueprint to show just what sequestration would mean, what it would cut, and they were due out last week. What happened?
Nothing. Nothing happened. They blew right through that deadline. They had 30 days. It was supposed to be September 6th, and September 6th rolled around, nothing. September 7th rolled around, nothing. We got a statement from the administration that said that because the issues they were looking at were very, very complicated, they needed a little more time. They're saying that this report will come out at the end of this week. We shall see. However, you know, presumably at least there's some debate over just how specific the sequestration plan the administration is supposed to produce is going to be. At least it's intended to be pretty detailed, supposed to spell out every account that would be affected under sequestration and how sequestration would affect it, including how much money would be cut from every program, project, and activity level. Well, so if they follow that, it could get pretty down into the weeds, and we could get a much fuller picture of exactly what these $109 billion in cuts would actually mean.
Right. Well, depending on who gets the blame for sequestration, if it happens, both sides, liberals, conservatives, Republicans, Democrats, would seem to have a way to want to kick this down the road. Because one of the ways the industry is putting pressure on the White House now is they are saying, look, the law in our state requires us to send out letters of intent to fire you to people within 30 to 60 days of the proposed dismissal. And we want to start sending those letters out. And the White House is saying, oh, I don't think that's such a very good idea.
And yeah, and it has come out just in the last day or two that several leading defense contractors have sent letters out saying that there will be layoffs if sequestration happens. So that is something that is very much looming on the agenda, the prospect of mass layoffs if sequestration does kick into effect. But what we are kind of lacking right now are a lot of details on precisely what it's going to mean. I mean, a lot of the numbers that we've been kind of throwing around, the potentially 270,000 lost federal jobs, those are coming from outside observers who are estimating what the effect of a roughly 11% cut just all at once would mean. We haven't seen official word specifically, so we're just kind of waiting to see. But we do know that it would most likely result in furloughs for thousands and thousands of employees. There are some estimates that 108,000 civilian employees of the Defense Department could lose their jobs next year. As you said earlier, 270,000 total across the government. And the Pentagon, for example, is probably going to have to seriously scale back its contract spending, use whatever flexibility it has. I mean, of course, there are some contracts where they're locked in, and they're going to most likely honor those contracts because it would make sense to try to save money by doing something that would net you penalties for breaking a contract. However, if they have, for example, multi-year contracts where they have the option of renewing or not renewing, they'll probably not renew those kinds of contracts. And it's going to hit every agency, probably more or less 10-11%. The last week we talked to John Adler of the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association, and he said that these cuts would really hit federal law enforcement, federal security personnel. He described it as turning our fortified castle into a wavering house of cards, and it's going to lead to equipment shortfalls for law enforcement if they need to, for example, replace their radios or upgrade their firearms or buy new vehicles. For example, the Border Patrol, they use a lot of SUVs on the border to patrol those rugged areas. It could potentially result in scaling back on the purchases of new vehicles for that.
Well, it would seem with the economy stagnant, recession still with us, 8% plus unemployment, bad job creation, and the kind of jobs that are being created are not quality paying jobs. Would seem like losing a half a million or a quarter million federal workers, federal jobs and contractors, as unpopular as they may be, this is not a good thing to happen before a congressional and a presidential election.
That's right. And that prospect has a lot of people scared. Your listeners may have heard people talking about the fiscal cliff that's coming up.
Yeah.
Sequestration is a major part of that fiscal cliff. And it has people very scared about what it's going to do to the economy. There's some fear that it could potentially, throw the country back into recession, that along with some of the other fiscal cliff aspects.
Well, so many of these politicians now, particularly House members, their districts have been drawn to this point where they're not even at play. they're going to be reelected. I don't know if it's 60% or something like that. Their jobs are safe. But when you have the American public out there fearful of that one or both breadwinners might lose their job, that ranks very high on a psychological stress scale.
Yeah, that's definitely right. And, yeah, the gerrymandering has rendered, you know, many, many, most congressional districts safe. Essentially, the elections are essentially meaningless for a lot of congressional districts. But, yeah, we could see, who knows, we could see a lot of people get really anxious and a throw-the-bums-out mm-hmm. mood kind of take hold.
Very good. Well, we got to throw our bums out here, too. So thank you very much, Steve Losey. Talk to you next week. Remember, the show is archived. You can listen anytime. We'll see you next Wednesday. Have a good week.